That's kind of conversation between the soul. That's conversation between the soul and the night.
Prestige heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade Derek Davison, and we come to you the day after Liberation Day. Derek and I are hooting, we are hollering, and we're just so excited for where this country is headed, clearly in a positive direction.
Well, we're liberated. I mean, I think that's the bottom line, is we're liberated.
As liberated peoples. So let's bring you the news. Starting off in the land of liberation, Derek, tell us about this risk of a U.S.-Iran conflict.
Yes, we may be liberating Iranians from the burden of having a functioning country, I guess. There's been a lot of chatter of late, and I felt like we should talk about it here, about the possibility of a U.S. military escalation vis-a-vis Iran. And to just recap where we are, Donald Trump several weeks ago sent Iran a letter, sent the Iranian government, Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei, a letter kind of asking him to consider negotiations over a new nuclear deal. You may recall Donald Trump tore up the last nuclear deal in 2018 during his first term. He wants to do another nuclear deal that I guess he would consider better than the one that Barack Obama negotiated. It would probably not be objectively better, but he would think of it that way because he did it. So he wants new negotiations. The Iranians have responded to that somewhat coolly. They've noted, understandably, that they don't feel like they can trust anything that Donald Trump agrees to, because, of course, or anything the United States agrees to, I guess, because of what happened in 2018. But they have offered the possibility of indirect negotiations. But in the meantime, Trump is, of course, bombing. He's restarted the America's Eternal War on Yemen, the Houthis. He's threatening Iran and the Houthis on a regular basis. He openly on Sunday threatened to bomb Iran if the nuclear deal doesn't come about, which supposedly in the letter that he sent to Khamenei, he gave Khamenei a 2-month timeline to get a deal done. Nobody knows when that timeline is supposed to have started, or if it's even started, or what it's pegged to. But he did have this sort of deadline beyond which, I guess, military action would be conceivable. His comments on Sunday, where, as I say, he just openly threatened to bomb Iran if he doesn't get a deal, drew a number of sharp responses from Iranian officials. There was an IRGC commander, the commander in their aerospace division, Amir Ali Hajizadeh, who basically threatened U.S. soldiers who are stationed in the Middle East. He said they're sitting in a glass house, which seems like a pretty easy threat to parse. Ali Larijani, who's a former parliament speaker of Iran and current senior advisor to Khamenei, said in a TV interview on Monday that basically if the United States or Israel were to attack Iran, Iran's nuclear facilities on the basis of what he called the nuclear pretext, that would drive Iran to actually develop a nuclear bomb, that this would be, the point of no return for that. So all of these things kind of rhetorically are not necessarily in a great place. Beyond that, you have the fact that the U.S. military has deployed now a second aircraft carrier to the region. It's deployed the USS Carl S. Vinson and its carrier group, which had been in kind of Asia Pacific, sent it to the Middle East. It's joining, when it gets there, it will join the Harry S. Truman and its carrier group, whose stay deployment in the Middle East region has been extended. So that gives the U.S. two carrier groups in the region. The U.S. military has also put at least half a dozen B-2 stealth bombers on Diego Garcia, which I think we may talk about later in another context. But that puts them well within range of striking Iran. Both of these things, I guess you could say, are related to the eternal war in Yemen, but that seems like a lot of firepower for the Houthis, no offense to them. So, there's speculation that Trump is marshaling resources in advance of some kind of military strike against the Iranians. Looming, I guess, in the background of all this, I mentioned the nuclear deal that Trump tore up in 2018. The tattered remnants of that deal, which was, of course, negotiated in 2015, includes other countries besides the United States and the United Nations. The tattered remnants of that deal are scheduled to sunset officially in October. And that basically means UN sanctions on Iran over its nuclear program that were suspended under the terms of the nuclear deal will be reimposed effectively because there's been no long-term resolution to the issue, or could be reimposed at least. This is all serious enough that the French government, Emmanuel Macron, called a meeting on Wednesday to discuss the possibility of a military confrontation between the U.S. And Iran, including his security cabinet, a number of experts. I don't know who that entails. The French foreign minister, Jean-Noël Barrot, told reporters after that meeting that a military confrontation is, quoting him here, almost inevitable unless there is some sort of new nuclear agreement. So we're in a very precarious position. Trump, according to Axios, is seriously considering the Iranians' offer of indirect negotiations, which I think Laura Rosen at her diplomatic newsletter has said the Iranians view as sort of a starting point, that you could open with these indirect talks. And if they go well, then you could maybe move to some sort of direct negotiation where some things could, more substantive things could actually get done. Of course, Donald Trump changes his mind on a whim. So if he wakes up tomorrow and has a bad morning, then who knows what he could do. His administration internally is divided between people who want to make a show of negotiating to try and get a deal before they start bombing and the people who just want to start bombing now. So there's a little bit of paralysis perhaps within the administration. And, again, Trump being as peculiar as he is, who knows? But he's, for right now, reportedly favors the idea of negotiations over the idea of just going straight to the conflict. But I don't think that's a strong preference.
Whenever the U.S. thinks it's out of the Middle East, they get pulled back in, Derek. They're never going to make this strategic transition, man. We've been talking about it for almost 15 years at this point. Yeah. They're just never going to be able to do it. They can't leave. Speaking of the region, let's talk about the Israeli government's rejection of another Gaza ceasefire and what the military is planning to do in terms of carving up the territory.
Over the weekend, Khalil al-Hayya, who's one of several senior Hamas political officials now, and after the death of Yahya Sinwar, they've sort of diversified their leadership a bit. But Hayya is certainly in a position to speak for the organization. Over the weekend, he said that they had accepted a ceasefire proposal that had been put forth by Egypt and Qatar. That would have seen imposed a 50-day truce. Hamas would have released five living captives over that period of time. Ostensibly during that 50 days, the Israelis and Hamas would have gotten down to actually negotiating the second phase, basically mythical second phase of the January ceasefire deal that's supposed to see a full cessation of hostilities, Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, et cetera, et cetera. The Israeli government immediately rejected it and proposed its own formula, the terms of which I don't even think are relevant at this point because they don't want to negotiate a deal. This is the point. Like, this is whack-a-mole. If Hamas accepted to the letter every detail of Israel's counter-proposal, the Israelis would probably find something wrong with that and say, no, we don't want that. We want something else. And we just could play this game over and over again. What they really are doing, and this gets into what they're doing inside the territory, is they're trying to implement Donald Trump's turn Gaza into Riviera, the Riviera of the Eastern Mediterranean, without any Palestinian population left in it, that plan. And so what's going on now is the IDF, the Israeli military, has been ordered to seize larger and larger chunks of territory within Gaza, piecemeal. They're building on these security zones or so-called security zones that they've created on the outskirts of Gaza and on the Netzarim corridor in the middle of Gaza to sort of expand those outward and continue emptying out territory, forcing more and more people into the one single strip of land along the coast, the Mawasi so-called safe zone. It's not really safe. The Israelis keep bombing it. But this is the one place where people are allowed to relocate. They're seizing territory in Rafah. They're seizing, you know, parts of Khan Yunis all over the place. They're doing this. Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, announced on Wednesday that he's ordered the IDF to open a new security corridor in addition to Netzarim and the Philadelphia corridor, which lies along the Egyptian border. This one's called the Morag Corridor. It's named after a former Israeli settlement that was positioned between Rafah and Khan Yunis in the southern part of Gaza. And so it looks like the parameters are not exactly understood, and Netanyahu didn't go into a lot of detail, but it sounds like what they're going to do is to cut Rafah off basically from the rest of Gaza with this new security corridor. And at that point, just empty it completely out of people, send them all to Mawasi, or, tell them to go to Mawasi, and then anybody who doesn't go will be ipso facto deemed an enemy combatant and eligible to be killed. Yeah, it's systematically driving the population into a very tiny area, a concentrated area, if you will, from which they could probably be involuntarily, or I'm sure we'd call it voluntary, but they could be moved out, at the Israeli government's discretion, if it decides to go full bore for the Trump plan and just ethnically cleanse the territory.
Thank you, Derek. Let's talk about the IDF, which has resumed the bombing of Beirut.
It's carried out a couple of strikes on southern Beirut over the last, week or so. The last several days. This is a new escalation. I mean, the Israelis haven't really ever maintained the November ceasefire with Hezbollah, but they had at least restricted their airstrikes to southern Lebanon, to eastern Lebanon. They had not returned to Beirut, but of course the Dahiya neighborhood in southern Beirut is Hezbollah's official headquarters. And so the Israelis have finally now a couple of times over the past week struck targets in Dahiya. They killed at least four people on Tuesday morning trying to kill, and I guess apparently they did kill, a Hezbollah official who was involved with the organization's Palestinian file, as the Israelis put it. These are obvious, violations of the ceasefire. They're obvious violations of Lebanese sovereignty. Both the new prime minister of Lebanon, Nawaf Salam, and the new president of Lebanon, Joseph Aoun, have commented that these are breaches of the ceasefire, that these are violations of sovereignty. They've sort of been pleading with the international community, i.e. the United States, to do something to rein the Israelis in, to no avail, because the international community, or really the United States, if we want to be specific about it, doesn't recognize any sort of Lebanese sovereignty, and neither does the Israeli government. So that hasn't gone anywhere, but this is definitely, I think, a point where if Hezbollah is going to itself decide that the November ceasefire is no longer applicable and that it needs, for whatever reason, to re-engage in conflict with the Israelis, resumption of airstrikes on Beirut is going to be the thing that does it.
Thanks, Derek. Let's talk about the Myanmar earthquake and the responses to it. So, yeah, I'm sure people have seen really horrifying videos from this, but what has been happening since the earthquake?
Yeah, it's been fairly nightmarish. A 7.7 magnitude earthquake struck near the Myanmar city of Mandalay on Friday. The death toll just, I think, on Thursday, the official death toll climbed above 3,000. It may go higher. I don't know how much higher. The last details I saw prior to the updated number on Thursday were that there were about 2,700 to 2,800 people dead and another 400 or so missing. I don't know if the government has a good handle on really how many people are missing, given how remote some of the places that were hit by this earthquake are, and given just the state of Myanmar being, you know, with big swaths of it under rebel control rather than government control, I'm not sure anybody has a great handle on this as they're keeping track of the toll that this earthquake has taken. The earthquake was widespread enough that it was felt, you know, in Bangkok and all across the region. I think there was an under construction skyscraper in Bangkok that came down. That's like 800 miles away from the epicenter of this earthquake, but that under construction skyscraper was brought down by the force of this thing. It was just huge. It was not both the magnitude and I guess it was very shallow in the earth's crust, which makes the tremors, the effects, more severe. You mentioned the response. It's been haphazard, as you might expect. There have been accusations that Myanmar's ruling junta is basically denying aid groups and aid material from reaching parts of the country that are under rebel control or are contested. It had not until Wednesday. It took all the way until Wednesday, 5 days before the junta even announced a ceasefire, which it's imposing until April 22nd. In its conflicts against Myanmar's various rebel groups, several rebel groups had already announced their own ceasefires by that point. So, you know, for 5 days, basically, as, you know, people were being pulled out of, bodies were being pulled out of rubble, and, you know, rescue work and recovery work was going on, the junta was still bombing villages that are under rebel control. It's just kind of a ghastly thing to conceive, but that's what was going on. As I say, it did impose a ceasefire on Wednesday. But the difficulty of relief efforts under the circumstances, given the fragmentation of Myanmar and the challenges in reaching some of the really remote kind of rural areas, make this very difficult. And of course, Donald Trump on Friday pledged U.S. support for the recovery effort. I don't think there's going to be any, because of course he has destroyed the agency USAID that would have handled that. And there's really nothing in place at this point to replace it. So I don't know how much assistance they're going to get from the U.S. They've gotten a fair amount from China, from Russia, from other countries in the region. I think things are still in a very, very dangerous situation right now.
Let's talk about South Korea, where the Yoon ruling is set for Friday, or the day that you, dear listeners, are listening to this.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention this because people will be hearing it. When people listen to this, the ruling will probably already be out. The South Korean Constitutional Court announced earlier this week that it will finally issue its ruling on Yoon Suk-yeol's impeachment on Friday. Six of the court's eight justices have to uphold the impeachment for Yoon to be removed from office. And if that happens, it will trigger a snap election for president that has to be held within 60 days. If the court overturns the impeachment, we will have ridiculous situation of a president who tried to do a self coup and then failed hours later and was impeached for it, returning to full-time duty in office. I don't know how he could possibly do that. It would seem to me he's going to be completely compromised on the job, but that is a possibility, I guess, that he could wind up staying in office somehow, and we'd have to see how that goes. I don't think it would be a very smooth process, but it is something to consider.
That'd be wild.
That would be pretty wild.
That would be pretty fucking wild. Let's talk about the Sudanese military, which has secured Khartoum.
The military, we talked about this last week, but it finally, on Friday, declared victory in its battle to retake Khartoum, the capital of Sudan, from the Rapid Support Forces militant group. It apparently was able, after having taken over the airport, the Republican Palace, the Central Bank, like a lot of the official buildings in central Khartoum, was apparently able to take out or seize the Rapid Support Forces main base or remaining foothold in the Jebel Aulia area, which is, I think, in the southern part of the city, issued a statement, trumpeting its seizure of the, what it called, the last pockets of the remnants of the Dagalo terrorist militia. Of course, the RSF is led by Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo. It's sort of a milestone in the conflict. I think it means a full shifting of resources and attention probably to Darfur and the Kordofan region, both of which the RSF has a much stronger position, especially in Darfur, where it is still besieging the city of Al-Fashir in North Darfur State, but most of the rest of the populated areas, at least, of Darfur, the heavily populated areas, are under RSF control. So that's probably where most of the effort is going to shift, assuming that the Sudanese military wants to retake those parts of the country and isn't going to just settle into a de facto partition, which is also, I guess, another possibility. We'll just have to see what happens next.
Thanks, Derek. Let's talk about the African Union, which has sent a mediation team to South Sudan.
Yeah, we've been talking about South Sudan for a few weeks now, the breakdown in the relationship between President Salva Kiir and Vice President Riek Machar, the former rivals, once again rivals, apparently, as Machar has been placed under house arrest. A number of people from his Sudan People's Liberation Movement and opposition party have been expunged from the government. There are conflicts between South Sudanese security forces and SPLM-IO cadres in various parts of the country. There have been conflicts between the South Sudanese forces and the so-called White Army in Upper Nile State, which is probably connected or maybe connected to Machar in some way, or Machar has, I think, claimed a connection in the past. It's not entirely clear how strong it is, but this country is on the verge of a resumption of the civil war that supposedly ended in 2018 when Kiir and Machar signed a peace agreement that has never been fully implemented, but still kind of, has been keeping the brakes on any return to conflict. The African Union did send a mediating mission to Juba on Wednesday to try to prevent a slide back into full-blown civil war. I don't know how that mission has gone as yet. There was an earlier mission this week. Raila Odinga, the former prime minister of Kenya, was sent on behalf of the regional Intergovernmental Authority on Development bloc. He didn't seem to meet with much success. He met with Kiir, but he was denied permission to speak to Machar, who is in custody. And I think his mission kind of fizzled out as a result of that. The AU had previously, the African Union had previously called for Machar to be released after his arrest. So I'm not sure they're going to get any better reception from Kiir and his government. We're at the stage of regional organizations trying to throw together whatever they can to prevent a resumption of war.
Let's talk about this United Kingdom Mauritius deal on the Chagos Archipelago, which has just received U.S. approval.
They are close to a final agreement, apparently, on this. The Chagos Islands, which the UK retained control of when it gave independence to Mauritius, in the mid-20th century, the Mauritian government has been trying to get control of the Chagos Islands back from the UK, or what it says is back. There's some disagreement with the Chagosians whether they were ever really supposed to be, were they were ever really part of Mauritius, or they should be independent. The upshot is the Mauritian government has been trying to get these islands from the UK for a long time now. And there was a deal reached, a draft agreement that was reached last year in November, but was held up partly because of the forthcoming the deal was reached in October, rather. The election, there was a Mauritian election in November that kind of held things up. And there's been a lot of criticism in both UK and US circles. The US is involved here because the largest of the Chagos Islands is Diego Garcia, which is where the US military has maybe its most important, strategically important overseas military base, or one of, a handful that are vitally strategically important, or at least the US military regards them as such. And so there's been concern about what could happen here. The UK leases that base to the United States, or, you know, I'm not sure it's a lease, with just kind of the goodness of their hearts, has, you know, given that base to the US for its use. There was some concern about what could happen to Diego Garcia, but the terms of the agreement that apparently is now in its final stages of being negotiated would have the Chagos being turned over to Mauritian control, but Diego Garcia, Mauritius would then turn around and lease that island to the UK for at least the next 99 years. So, you know, good news, I guess. I know you were worried about the base, Danny. It looks like
haven't been able to sleep, Derek.
Be safe. Haven't been able to sleep another century. Yeah.
Thank the Lord. Okay, let's turn to a big one. Russia, Ukraine, and Trump is, as we call in the internet business, big mad at both Putin and Zelensky.
Yeah, this is over the weekend. We got a whole array of stories. Somebody at the White House was doing some broad leaking to various media outlets about how Donald Trump was reportedly, and I'm going to quote from Al Jazeera here, angry and pissed off at Russian President Vladimir Putin. This was after Putin on Friday gave another one of these amusing kind of snarky responses to a question about negotiating peace deal with Ukraine, where he questioned Volodymyr Zelensky's legitimacy, given that Zelensky, under martial law, which is the appropriate thing to do under Ukrainian law, canceled last year's presidential election. Putin has maintained for some time now that this makes Zelensky an illegitimate dictator and that he can't possibly negotiate a peace deal. I mean, his concern for the rule of law in the country that he invaded is touching. He's insisted that he can't negotiate with Zelensky, and Zelensky wouldn't be able to sign legitimately a peace deal. So on Friday, you know, he renewed this objection and kind of wondered whether there could be like a UN administration installed on a temporary basis that could negotiate or something else, you know, what other arrangements the international community could come up with to get around this horrible issue that Volodymyr Zelensky is not legitimately the president of Ukraine anymore. Trump got pissed off about this, which seems a little odd because Donald Trump has said the same thing about Zelensky after the Oval Office spat that they had. Trump referred to him as a dictator over the same exact issue because he canceled last year's presidential election. So I don't know. This is all, you know, how Donald Trump's beautiful mind works. I try not to think about it very much. But he is mad at Putin, telling people that he's frustrated, that Russia has kind of slow rolled ceasefire negotiations, you know, which is the first step toward peace deal. I guess if he gets mad enough, if he gets big enough mad, this could turn into new sanctions on Russia. But I'm not sure that we're at that point yet. He is also, though, as it should be noted, he's also losing patience with Zelensky. And this is over the mineral rights deal, which continues to kind of roil this relationship. I think we talked last week about the Trump administration offering a new minerals deal after the old one kind of got blown up again during the Oval Office argument, that a little embarrassing episode. The new minerals deal that the U.S. is offering is even more exploitative than the previous one. It takes a bigger chunk of the Ukrainian economy as compensation for the supposed loans or of support that the U.S. has been giving to Ukraine, which Zelensky does not regard as loans and were probably not pitched to him as loans by the Biden administration, but that's how Trump regards them. Zelensky has been very frosty, very cool about this deal. He said, you know, we're studying it. It seems a little bit over the top. We're not entirely sure we can agree to it as it's written. And Trump told reporters on Sunday that Zelensky, he said, is trying to back out of the rare earth deal. And if he does that, he's got some big, big problems. So Trump, as I say, not terribly thrilled with either of these guys at this point. They're not bending to his will, I guess.
Let's talk about El Salvador and the cover-up there.
This was reported by DropSite several days ago, Sunday, I believe, that the basically there's an element to the deal that the Trump administration reached with Nayib Bukele on which allowed the U.S. to expel basically a bunch of not just Salvadorans, but Venezuelan alleged gang members. They weren't given any due process. So how do we know? But that, of course, expelled hundreds of people to El Salvador to be shunted into Bukele's massive counterterrorism prison. A few weeks ago, part of the deal, according to DropSite, was that the Trump administration agreed to return a man, a figure from the MS-13 gang, a man named Cesar Humberto Lopez Larios, or a.k.a. Greñas. And according to DropSite, this guy is high up enough in MS-13 that he has knowledge of some embarrassing interactions between MS-13 and Bukele's government. Bukele has denied steadfastly for his entire presidency that he has been negotiating with MS-13 on what it amounts to an agreement to kind of take it easy on MS-13 as long as they lower the level of gang violence and give him a political win in that sense. And Bukele has rejected he's rejected it as basically slander, is untrue. But apparently this guy has knowledge that these negotiations have been going on. And Bukele was very keen to get him out of the U.S. before U.S. prosecutors had a chance to talk to him and potentially reveal that these negotiations have been going on. And so the Trump administration obliged as part of the arrangement that opened up the opportunity to expel all these people to El Salvador, obliged him by sending this guy in the group of 238, I think it was, or 250-some people to El Salvador to further the cover-up, basically, to maintain it for him.
And what about this apology?
This is really awful. So we know that of all the people who were sent back to El Salvador, none of them basically were given, very few of them at least, were given due process. There's no proof in many cases that these people were part of any gang, whether it's MS-13 or Tren de Aragua or any other criminal organization. But the administration has openly admitted now that at least one of these people was shipped back due to what it called an administrative error, a man named Kilmer Abrego Garcia, and it was apparently classified as being a member of MS-13, but there was no evidence of that. It's never been proven. He's never been convicted of a crime related to being an MS-13. The Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency did say that they carried out his removal in good faith, so I guess we got to give that but he has been shunted into this, hellhole, this massive prison in El Salvador for apparently no good reason. Even as I say, the administration says this was a mistake and he shouldn't have been sent there. But it also says that it has no legal authority to get him out of the Salvadoran prison. It had no legal authority to send him in the first place, but that's, I guess, water under the bridge. And this is really just like terrifying shit. I mean, this guy's life is ruined. He's stuck in a Salvadoran prison, without any recourse, I guess, or at least no recourse that the Trump administration is willing to engage in. To try and get him out. It's just sort of saying, oopsie, sorry about that, but there's nothing we can do about it now.
Derek, our beautiful National Security Council has been shaped by friend of the pod, Laura Loomer. What is going on?
I don't really know. Like, this is from, there was a story in Axios, I think The Guardian has it as well, that Laura Loomer, the hanger-on who has some kind of relationship with Trump, I don't really know, but she visited the White House, I guess, on Wednesday and brought with her a list of people on the National Security Council who she wants fired, ostensibly because they're neocons. And, you know, the Trump administration is trying to purge neocons, at least in theory. It's got a bunch of them working for him, his Secretary of State, for example. But I digress. But she's very mad that there's all these neocons on the National Security Council. And so she gave Trump this list of people who should be fired. As it happens, the Trump administration is on Thursday firing a bunch of people from the National Security Council. And I don't think anybody has established a direct link between the list that Laura Loomer supposedly gave Trump and these firings. But the coincidence is pretty hard to miss. So, you know, I don't have details really here, or, you know, much of any information about who exactly is being fired or what their backgrounds are, but it is a just another day in paradise, I guess, for people living under the Trump administration.
And let's end on the big news of the week, which is, of course, these tariffs.
Yes. As you noted earlier, Wednesday was Liberation Day. We're all liberated from a lot of money or the need to buy any consumer goods that don't cost a lot of lot more money than they should, because Donald Trump has imposed a really, I think, exceeding in some cases, like people's worst case expectations, has imposed a massive array of new tariffs on virtually, you know, nearly every country. The only countries that got away without, I think, North Korea, which doesn't, of course, export anything to the United States, Russia, which is already under heavy sanctions still from because of Ukraine, Mexico and Canada have their own tariff dealings with the Trump administration. But for the most part, just about everybody else is getting hit with at least a baseline 10% tariff on imported goods on pretty much, it seems like, everything. The details are still being worked out, I think, but the initial analysis was that there's going to be a 10% tariff on pretty much everything coming into the United States now. But there's a special group of countries, around 60 countries, that the administration singled out for being particularly unfair in their trade practices. And some of them are absurd, like Lesotho, which you know, has the one of the tiniest economies in the world. Several Australian islands, including a couple where I don't think there are any people living on them, got singled out for higher tariffs. I don't totally understand how that works. But the numbers are shocking. There are tariffs on an additional 34% tariff on products coming from China, which was already at, I think, 20% across the board, and in some areas even higher than that. 46% tariff on goods coming from Vietnam, 49% on Cambodia. Like, these are some of the higher end ones, but the, you know, 20% on goods coming from the European Union. So just a huge kind of a lot of carnage on the free trade front, I guess, is where we're at. And the effects are already being felt on the stock market. I don't know if anybody cares that much about this, but the stocks are not doing well today. They're down
the
quite a bit.
The stocks aren't doing well, Derek.
There's been a little bit of a stock ball. They're down quite a bit. The Dow's down, I think, 3%, and NASDAQ and all these, I don't know, all the different things, but they're not doing great is the point. People are still assessing this. I don't have much more to say, because I think a lot of the analysts who were watching this are sort of in shock today at the extent of what he announced, and still trying to figure out what the ramifications could be.
Well, it's times like this, Derek, that I'm glad we put all of our money, not in the stock market, but in Beanie Babies and NFTs. Everyone, absolutely. Thank you so much for listening. And as always, keep on rocking in the free world. Bye.
Bye.
Hackers don't need much. Just one leaked password can potentially unlock a treasure trove of personal information, leading to stress, pain, and permanently wrecked credit. Don't be an easy target. Get protection by Aura today. Aura protects your identity, finances, and family, all in one powerful app. Get real-time alerts, safeguard your accounts, and block scams before they happen. If identity theft strikes, we help you recover. Stay protected at aura.com/listen. That's aura.com/listen.